Chapter 27. St. Julian Perlmutter stepped into his spacious Georgetown carriage house and cast an appreciative glance around at the hundreds of volumes, old and new, that spilled off the sagging wall shelves and flowed like a vast river of words, breaking off into tributaries that ran into every room. An ordinary human being confronted with this seeming confusion would have fled the premises. A beatific smile came to his lips as his eye lingered on one stack, then moved on to another. He could rattle off titles, even quote whole pages from what was generally acknowledged to be the world's most complete collection of literature on historic ships. He was starved after dealing with the rigors of a transatlantic flight. Finding space aboard a plane to accommodate his substantial bulk was not a problem. He simply reserved two seats. But even the offerings of first class were, to Perlmutter's way of thinking, the equivalent of a church ham and bean supper. He headed for the kitchen like a heat-seeking missile and was glad to see that the housekeeper had followed his shopping instructions. Even though it was early in the day, before long he was dining on a Provençal-style stuffed lamb with potatoes perfumed with thyme and washed down with a simple but well-balanced Bordeaux. Thus fortified, he was dabbing at his tulip mouth and magnificent gray beard with a napkin when the phone rang. "Kurtz," he said, recognizing the voice on the line, "how in blazes did you know I was back?" "There was a report on CNN that Italy had run out of pasta. I assumed you would be coming home for a square meal." "No," Perlmutter boomed. "Actually, I returned because I missed being taunted on the phone by impertinent young whippersnappers who should know better." "You sound in fine fettle, St. Julian. It must have been a good trip." "It was, and I do feel as if I've eaten all the pasta in Italy. But it's good to be back on my own turf." "I wondered what you had turned up on my historical query." "I was going to call you later today. Fascinating material. Can you drop by? I'll brew up some coffee and we can talk about my findings." 5 minutes. I just happened to be driving through Georgetown." When Austin arrived, Perlmutter served two giant cups of cafe latte. He pushed aside a pile of books to reveal a chair for Austin and another stack to make room for his own wide haunches on an oversized sofa. Perlmutter sipped his coffee. "Well now, getting down to business. After you called me in Florence, I discussed your query about the Roland relics with my host, a Signor Nocci. He remembered a historical reference he had seen in a letter to the Medici Pope, penned by a man named Martinez, who was a fanatical supporter of the Spanish Inquisition, particularly where it applied to the Basques. Mr. Nocci put me in touch with an assistant curator at the Laurentian Library. She dug out a manuscript written by Martinez in which he directs particular venom at Diego Aguirre's." "The ancestor of Balthazar, the man I met. Good work." Perlmutter smiled. "That's only the start. Martinez says flatly that Aguirre's had the sword and the horn of Roland, and that he would pursue him, and I quote, to the ends of the earth to retrieve these objects." Austin let out a low whistle. "That establishes that the Roland relics were real and puts them directly in the hands of the Aguirre's family. It would seem to verify the rumors that Diego was in possession of the sword and horn." Perlmutter passed over a folder. "This is a copy of a manuscript from the Venice State Archives. It was found at the Naval Museum in a file having to do with war galleys." Austin read the title on the first page. "An Exoneration of a Man of the Sea." The publication date on the frontispiece was 1520. The preamble described the work as an account by Richard Blackthorne, an unwilling mercenary in the service of the Spanish Inquisition, a humble sailor who has always stood in defense of Her Majesty's name, in which he proves infamies that have been brought against him to be untrue, and warns any and all never to trust the murdering Spaniards. He glanced up at Perlmutter. Blackthorne is surely a master of the never-ending sentence, but what does he have to do with Roland and the long-dead Aguirres? Everything, my lad. Everything. He looked into the bottom of his coffee cup. While you're up, old boy, would you fetch me a refill? I'm feeling peaked after the rigors of travel. Get one for yourself. Austin had no intention of getting up, but he rose from his chair and went for the refill. He knew that Perlmutter functioned best when he was eating or drinking. Perlmutter sipped his coffee and ran his hand over the manuscript as if he were reading it with his fingers. You can study this at your leisure, but I'll give you a quick summary now. Apparently Blackthorne fell afoul of rumors that he had willingly served the hated Spaniard, and he wanted to set the record straight. That came across loud and clear in the preamble. Blackthorne was worried about the stain on his name. He was born of a respectable merchant family in Sussex. He went to sea as a youth and worked his way up from cabin boy to master of a merchant vessel plying the Mediterranean. He was captured by Barbary pirates and forced to become a rower on an Algerian galley. The galley was shipwrecked, and he was rescued by the Genoese, who turned him over to the Spanish. Remind me never to be rescued by the Genoese. Blackthorne was a hot potato. According to the Inquisition system, any Englishman was a heretic and subject to torture, arrest, and execution. English and Dutch sailors shunned Spanish ports for fear they would be arrested. If you were caught with a copy of the King James Bible or possessed some ancient classic deemed heretical, you were, to put it literally, toast. Austin glanced down at the folder. Either Blackthorne survived or his memoirs were ghostwritten. He had 9 lives, our Captain Blackthorne. He actually escaped once from the Spanish and was recaptured. He was eventually dragged from his dark cell in irons to stand trial. The prosecutor called him an enemy of the faith and other opprobrious names, as he put it. He was condemned to death and was headed for the stake when fate intervened in the unlikely form of El Bracero. Isn't that the name of a Mexican restaurant in Falls Church? You're asking the wrong man. I've always considered Mexican and restaurant uttered in the same sentence as no less an oxymoron than military intelligence. El Bracero means brazier in Spanish. It was the nickname given the aforementioned Martinez for his zeal in putting the torch to heretics. Not the type you would invite to a barbecue. No, but he proved to be Blackthorne's savior. The Englishman impressed Martinez with his resourcefulness and his ability to speak Spanish. But more important, Blackthorne was familiar with war galleys and sailing ships. That shows the lengths to which Martinez would go to catch Aguirre's, even sparing a victim. Oh, yes. We know from his writings that he thought Aguirre's was especially dangerous because he had been charged with the stewardship of the Roland relics and might use them to rally his countrymen against the Spaniards. When Aguirre's escaped arrest in his ship, Martinez went after him. Blackthorne was commanding Bracero's lead galley when they caught up with Aguirre's on his caravel off the coast of France in 1515. Although he was becalmed, outnumbered, and outgunned, Aguirre's managed to sink 2 galleys and put Martinez to flight. The more I learn about Diego, the more I like him. Perlmutter nodded. His strategy was brilliant. I intend to include this fight in a collection I'm preparing of classic sea battles. Unfortunately, Bracero had the services of an informer who knew that Aguirre's always stopped in the Faroe Islands to rest before crossing the ocean to North America. Austin leaned forward in his chair and murmured, Skullshown. You know it. I was in Skullshown a few days ago. Can't say I'm familiar with the place. Can't blame you, it's quite remote. A picturesque little fishing village with a natural harbor of refuge. There are some interesting caves nearby. Caves? The blue eyes danced with excitement. Quite an extensive network. I've seen them. From the drawings on the walls, I'd say they've been occupied off and on going back to ancient times. The Basques or others may have been using them for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. Blackthorne mentions the caves in his narrative. In fact, they were instrumental in his story. In what way? Aguirre's could easily have outdistanced his pursuers and fled to North America, where Bracero would never find him. The Basques were the only mariners intrepid enough to sail the Atlantic in those days. But Diego knew that Bracero would go after his family. And he knew that even if he stashed the relics in North America, that when he returned to Europe, Bracero would be waiting. Maybe he decided to take a stand for the most primal of reasons, Austin said. He wanted his revenge on the man who had ruined his life and stolen his fortune. No disagreement there. Bracero was just as determined to finish the job he'd started. He had switched from his galley to a warship twice the size of Diego's caravel. He had put Blackthorne in command. The ship bristled with guns that would have made short work of the Basques. But Diego knew from their previous encounter of the informant on board Bracero's ship and prudently moved the caravel away from the caves. Diego stationed a handful of his men on shore where they could be seen by Bracero, and when Martinez launched his boats, the men ran into the caves, drawing their pursuers after them. I smell a trap. You've got a better nose than Martinez, although in fairness, he was probably distracted by thoughts of all the fun he was going to have burning Diego and his crew. Shades of Custer's Last Stand. That cave system is a labyrinth, perfect to stage an ambush. Then I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that's what happened. It was a two-pronged strategy. The caravel swept down on the warship and cowed its skeleton crew with a few cannon shots. Then they boarded the ship and took it over. Meanwhile, Diego launched his ambush. He had dragged one of his ship's cannon into the caves and used it to take the wind out of the attack. Perlmutter raised a pudgy fist as if he were reliving the battle. Bracero was a skilled swordsman, but Aguirre's was better. Instead of killing him, he toyed with Martinez before he doused Bracero's flame forever. Where was Mr. Blackthorne in all this? One of Bracero's men went to take a shot at Diego. Blackthorne killed the man. Diego had his men bring Blackthorne to him. The Englishman laid out his story. Diego needed a skilled captain to command the warship, so he made a deal. Blackthorne would take charge of the ship and get Diego's men home safely. Several weeks later, by Blackthorne's account, he sailed up the Thames with his prize. What happened to the Roland relics? Blackthorne never mentions them. But by his account, Diego called for a small volunteer crew to stay with him and sent the others home with Blackthorne. He no longer needed gunners and cannon crew, only skilled sailors. Even with Bracero dead, he knew the relics would not be safe as long as the Inquisition was alive. So, he continued west, never to be heard from again. Another unsolved mystery of the sea. Maybe not, Austin said. He handed Perlmutter the news clip about the Zeppelin crash. Perlmutter read the story and looked up. These items could be the long-lost relics. My thoughts exactly. Which means they're in the hands of Oceanus. Would Oceanus give them up? Austin thought of his run-ins with the Oceanus thugs. Not likely, he said, with a rueful chuckle. Perlmutter gazed at Austin over tented fingers. It seems there is more to this whole saga than meets the eye. A hell of a lot more, and I'll be glad to fill you in on the gory details over another cup of coffee. He lifted his cup. As long as you're up, old boy, could you fetch me a refill? Get one for yourself.